Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Well, we've had a decidedly chilly end to the summer and sort of a warmish beginning to the autumn. And the winter weather is on the way. The Atlantic hurricane system coming to an end, a season, I should say, coming to an end. Always a fun guest to have on the show is News Channel 13 meteorologist Jason Goff. If you've seen him on TV, you know his forecasts and his explanations of the weather are great because they're A, detailed, and B, the regular person can understand them. And that's a great thing indeed. An Albany native, Goff joined the News Channel 13 First Warning Weather Team in 2004 after attending school at Auburn University and the University of Maryland. His first on-air forecasting job was in Corpus Christi, Texas in 2001. And his forecasts have been broadcast right here on WAMC for years. Jason, nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you, sir. Very much so. I'm always glad to be here, and thank you for the kind words.
The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. There are so many ways you can get in touch with us online nowadays, and I'll try to read them before the end of the program. Here we go. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can comment on our Vox Pop wall post on Facebook, WAMC Radio. You can go to our show page, WAMC.org/VoxPop, comment there. You can even email VoxPop@WAMC.org, but we do love your calls, 1-800-348-2551. So I think, Jason, the last time you were on was before the beginning of the hurricane season, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, in the springtime.
Yeah, and how's the hurricane season been? Not too many majors this year.
No, it's been pretty quiet, which, of course, is a good thing. We've had only one quote-unquote major hurricane, which is a Category 3 or higher. That was Edouard, actually early last week. It took off, went out to sea, and that's all she wrote, man. It stayed away from Bermuda, made its way over toward the Azores, and that's been it. So it's been a pretty quiet season. Nothing going on in the Atlantic right now. And there's, you know, climatologically, our peak, the peak day of hurricane season is September 11th, and it's a kind of a sharp climb up and a pretty steep drop off after that. There's one more little kind of peak that shows up in October around the middle of the month. And typically there we'll look more into the Gulf of Mexico. The west coast of Florida is a little bit more in kind of in the zone, if you will. Wilma back in 2005 is a good example. There was one that hit in the panhandle of Florida when I was down in Florida. When I was down at Auburn, I should say, that came up. So, you know, in October you kind of watch the Gulf. But things right now are pretty quiet. There's still quite a bit of shear going on in the Caribbean and in the Gulf. So all things are good at the moment.
All right. So shear is vertical wind that cuts the...
No, shear is basically, well, there are a couple of different ways to look at it. One, shear is just a change of wind direction with height. But in this particular case, you hear about that when you talk about tornadoes and thunderstorm development, yeah, things like that. But wind shear in this, you want to think about it at, like, let's say you go to an old-time tavern and you get a big draft beer, all right, or an ice cream soda, whichever. Yeah,
yeah, okay.
That's happened all before. Right. Or, you know, an ice cream soda, and you get that big froth up on the top and the,
yep,
foam. Imagine just blowing that off. That's kind of what shear is. And so, in essence, what it does is, as is the case in thunderstorms, the higher they are up in the atmosphere, the nastier they are. But if you have shear in the mid and upper levels of the atmosphere, it blows these tops off so they don't get a chance to kind of percolate, and it essentially chokes off the system.
Interesting. So does it take away the density of the storm, or is it just pulling the energy away?
It just kind of flattens out the energy's potential, if you will, and it just doesn't allow it to continue to grow. I mean, these storms get all of their energy from the warm water, the latent heat of condensation. It's a big, huge amounts of energy. But if you kind of choke off that process, you can have all the latent heat around you want. But if these storms aren't developing, then you're not going to get the storm to get going.
We're joined by News Channel 13 meteorologist Jason Goff here on Vox Pop. Number to call is 1-800-348-2551. And we'll get to your calls in just a moment. Perception is a funny thing. But my perception of this summer is it hasn't been too warm. There haven't been too many real hot spells. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. It was a warm summer for the most part. August was a little cooler than average. We only had four 90-degree days, and we had two 90-degree days and two 91-degree days, and that was it.
Yeah.
So we didn't have any in August, and, you know, that's kind of the measuring stick that a lot of people – and it's not wrong. We had 6 days in a row of 90 degrees, and then people remember that and go, geez, it was hot.
Yeah.
But, you know, we had a fair amount of 80s. The first couple of days of this month were warmer than any in August, so it's
indeed,
just kind of the way it is. So – But, you know, the summer was good. It was relatively dry and continues to be quite dry now, actually. And, you know, we're the average for 90-degree days is 10.4, so we had four this summer.
Okay, so a little under.
Yeah.
Does that necessarily prove predictive of a colder winter?
No.
Not at all?
No, sir.
All right, well, let's go to the phones, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Merle in Argyle. Merle, you're up.
Oh, I get first, huh?
Yep,
yes,
you're
sir.
In.
All right, this has to do with what you were just talking about, global temperatures and stuff. The Post-Star, Glenn Spall, said that June, July, August were the hottest in record, and we were probably below normal for heat for those 3 months. Is that correct?
We were below average in August. We were pretty much spot on for June and July. But overall, the country itself was really hot. It was really hot down in the midsection of the country, and especially out west. The east, basically east of the Mississippi, the summer, comparatively speaking, wasn't all that bad. But globally, it was the warmest summer on record, yes.
And so the other part of that question is that, and we had a very severe or colder, quite a bit colder winter last year, way above what, above norm.
Above norm?
Yeah.
With 300 plus heating degree days. He can explain what that is. But,
yes.
We had been averaging like 300 below heating degree days for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So can we expect a similar result this winter, or it's just a period of chance?
Okay.
No, yeah, that's, and I'm glad you bring that up, because I always tell people this: no matter if you see woolly bear caterpillars on the bike path, or if you see a lot of acorns, or if the summer was hot or cool, or if last winter was snowy or not snowy, or warmer or milder than normal or colder than normal, it doesn't mean anything. It really doesn't. I don't care what anybody says. I will debate you to the nth degree. You cannot tell me that in this part of the country, that is. Now, I'm talking just about our area.
Yeah.
I always just tell people, I have no idea what this winter's going to be like, and neither does anybody else. NOAA puts out their seasonal outlooks.
Even though the global warming predicted that this would be cool, we would be cooler in the Northeast.
Well, I mean, you're talking about two completely different things there. Ultimately, what we're looking at is the upcoming winter. And
yeah.
So what you're talking about is NOAA will put out seasonal outlooks for each of the season. And they basically, for the Northeast, if you ever see that, every time, and through no fault of theirs, they'll say the Northeast has equal, below, or above chances of precipitation and temperature, which means
right.
It's a complete crapshoot. It's a 50-50 shot.
A crapshoot.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, but the reason for that is it's not because the people in NOAA don't know what they're doing, because they certainly do. And those outlooks are a lot more relevant to people out in, say, California with the ENSO patterns, El Nino, La Nina, and the like, and the desert Southwest and Texas and those places. But for the Northeast, especially as it relates to snowfall, our big snows come from the coast. So you can't tell 10 days out, much less, you know, 3 months out, what kind of a winter we're going to have, because these storms are so fickle. They can just, you know.
That's for snowfall, but I'm talking about, like, heating degrees.
Okay.
Well, when you're talking about temperature, again, some of that also has to do with those types of systems, but how much troughiness we get in the wintertime, it's difficult to predict overall if we're going to have a colder than average winter or a warmer than average winter. So basically just buckle up and prepare for it. That's all I can tell you.
Jason Goff is our guest. He is a News Channel 13 meteorologist. Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Last year, the annoying phrase of the year was, go ahead, say it.
Oh, for crying out loud, the polar vortex.
That's right.
Good gravy.
Is that going to be a problem this year?
The only problem will be if we hear it on the news 800 times. You don't hear it on News Channel 13. To me, it's a hype tool. It really is, and it drives me nuts. It drives us crazy at the station. And this is not a commercial for News Channel 13, but we don't hype the weather. We just tell it like it is. The
yeah.
polar vortex has been around for a long time. My guess is that a TV consultant said, ooh, let's use this and try to get people – interested in the weather, and which is fine in and of itself, but it, to me, it went way too far.
So did Kovacic gather you guys around and say, look, we're not saying this. Don't ever say
no, it. No, we, you know, I built a graphic for it to explain what the polar vortex is and to sort of, in a sense, demystify it just to let people know. And again, that's what we do. We're just there to inform.
Yeah.
We don't hype stuff up and say, look, here's the deal. The polar vortex has been around for a long time, and it's going to be cold sometimes, and sometimes it's not. And I even heard about it this summer, almost threw a brick through the TV.
Yes, absolutely. All right, we'll hold that thought. We'll get back because it did rear its ugly head in early August. Back with Jason Goff and your calls at 1-800-348-2551 in a moment.
Support for WAMC comes from Snow Farm, studio craft workshops for adults and teens, glass blowing, woodworking, ceramics, jewelry, and much more. Simple dorms, homemade meals, and four seasons in Williamsburg, Massachusetts. Snowfarm.org. Autobahn Service, Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Offering service, repair, and diagnosis of imports, specializing in late model Volkswagen, Audi, and BMW. AutobahnTechnic.com. NBT Bank. Offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses, nbtbank.com. Unison Arts Center, New Paltz, presenting in concert the Alt Bluegrass Band Uncommon Ground with Mike Kobetish and Wayne Fugate, Saturday at 8, unisonarts.org. Handcrafted unfinished solid wood furniture with a custom finishing shop on premises, handcrafted furniture in an array of wood types for the house, AdirondackWoodshed.com.
All righty, buckle down. The fun drive starts October 6th, 6 a.m. Alan Chartok will be at the helm here in Pledge Central. And it's a big fun drive, but if you want to make it shorter, go to WAMC.org right now and pony up to the old lockbox. Everything we raise in the lockbox between now and the beginning of the drive counts on day one. WAMC.org. You can get some cool stuff, too. Jason Goff is our guest. It's Vox Pop. We talk weather. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. And the polar vortex showed up, was it late July, early, right before my vacation. And I said, oh, God, it's going to freeze up in Maine. And, of course, there was nothing to it.
No, it was a little chilly in the northern plains. But it was just, you know, it was a chunk of chillier air. I mean, it's cold in the North Pole, even in the summertime. So, you know, sometimes a chunk of that cold air breaks off and heads our way.
All right, here's one from email. This is from Paul. The old adage, be prepared, is an important one to follow. However, some of the meteorological forecasts border on the edge, creating sort of a hysteria at the gas stations, grocery stores, etc. And you always see that at a grocery store before a storm.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not necessarily a bad idea.
No.
Paul goes on, living in the great Northeast, one should be prepared at all times for any weather event. It's amazing the number of people who aren't. Be that as it may, after one or two weather events that don't occur, people tend to fall into an apathetic state of mind, which I find dangerous. Comments?
Yeah, he's spot on. I mean, you know, we've been talking about it. You've heard Governor Cuomo talk about preparedness, certainly after Sandy, just to be ready, and after Irene before Sandy, too, yeah. Of course, and Lee and everything else. We always have to, you know, the weather around this part of the country overall is fairly benign. I mean, we don't generally have to deal with hurricanes as often as other parts of the country, certainly tornadoes and even, you know, nasty snowstorms. But certainly we get all of those things. So
yep.
We always have to be prepared for them. As far as, you know, people, I mean, inevitably, and it's not just here, it's everywhere. I mean, I lived in Washington, D.C. You want to see people freak out when it snows?
Half an inch of
snow.
Holy
cow.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
Even in Westchester, where I used to work, you got an inch of snow and people were off the road and
I think people overall, and this is my little barstool theory on this.
Okay.
I'll put this out there for everybody to hear. I think that people, no matter whether they want, if they want to admit it or not, they get excited about snow. It brings the kid out in you. Unless it's going to mess up some travel plans that you have, people get excited about it. And if a forecast does not verify, we hear from those people. And I get it. I really do, man. It, you know, you're like, and especially the folks that rely on the snow for their livelihoods, plows and
sure.
stuff like that. But, you know, I can tell you that we do the very best that we can do. That goes without saying. And as I said just a little while ago, these storms can be a little fickle when they come up the coast. And if they jog a little to the east or to the west, it makes a huge difference for us in terms of a forecast.
So in a perfect world, say 50 years down the road, 100 years down the road, I'll let you play Nostradamus here for a minute. Will computer models get so good that suddenly then 3 days is not your limit for accuracy, but maybe 20 days will be your limit? Do you ever see a day when that'll happen?
I have a hard time believing that it would be that far out. I think certainly going higher than 3 days is a possibility. Dr. Louis Uccellini is now in charge of the National Weather Service, and I know we've got some calls, so
yeah,
I'll make
right
this quick.
You
know, the goal of the United States, and this became a lot more evident after Sandy, was to be able to compete with the Europeans in terms of computing speed, and computing speed is always on the rise. The problem is that there are so many variables in the atmosphere. We could have a 20-day forecast, but it might take 40 days to make it.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
So we need higher, you know, faster computer speed. They're trying to get that done, but as you might imagine, it's being a little gridlocked.
All right, let's go to Mark in Kingston. Mark, thanks for waiting.
Hi. Yeah, I was just wondering if there was a relationship between the polar vortex and the Gulf Stream, which has been a little unusual. They're catching some strange fish in areas much further north in California because of the Gulf Stream. I was wondering if there's any relationship with the weather with that.
Well, what you have, Mark, in the Gulf Stream is actually in the eastern United States. It comes up from the equator. Overall, basically what the planet is trying to do is to equal itself out. Okay, if Mother Nature had her way, it would be the same temperatures everywhere. And that's why we have wind. That's why we have these currents of water that are trying to transport warm to cold and cold to warm. The Gulf Stream comes up from the equator through the Caribbean, makes its closest spot to the United States right around West Palm Beach, and then it kind of ducks out to the northeast from there, south of Newfoundland and over toward the British Isles. So that's the Gulf Stream. Now, what Mark, what you're talking about here, on the other side, there's actually an opposite current called the California Current, and that transports colder water down from the north, from the polar region. That's why the water temperature in Miami is a lot warmer than it is in San Diego, okay, during the summertime.
Mm.
So what you're referring to as far as they're catching fish, that's a function of water temperatures on the rise. Fish are very sensitive, and being a lifetime fisherman, fish are very sensitive to temperatures and temperature changes, and they're going to follow those. As far as the polar vortex being equated with those currents, you know, one obviously is air and one is water, but there are constant interactions between these two different biomes, if you will, when you have air and water do interact all the time. As far as the polar vortex and the Gulf Stream goes, they don't have any real discernible similarities.
Okay. Mark, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. Meteorologist Jason Goff is our guest. Let's go to Tony in Montgomery County. Tony, you're on.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Yes, sir.
Jason, I have a quick question for you. We frequently hear about modeling, and earlier in the year, I heard weather forecasts based on the American model versus the European model.
Yes.
And some of those nor'easters earlier in the year, it seemed that the European model was a little more accurate than what the American model was. Can you just explain, you know, how the different models weight different variables and why there is such a difference in their predictive nature?
Yeah, we started to talk about this a little while ago.
Yeah, yeah. Tony, never was that more evident when it came to Sandy.
Yep.
Because the so-called American model, the GFS, the Global Forecast System model, didn't have it until 2 days out, and the European model had it. It was up to almost 6 days out. I remember looking
with
at
how much accuracy in the long run.
The European basically hammered it. I mean,
yeah,
they almost nailed it. And I mean, 6 days out, you're talking about northern New Jersey versus southern New Jersey. And it actually would have worked out better for New York City, worse for us, obviously, if the euro had verified completely. But to your point, the European model is a lot more accurate overall than the GFS because they have faster computing speed. And I'll throw some numbers out here, too, that might turn your stomach a little bit. After Sandy, there was a big push in Congress to say, all right, we are going to compete with the Europeans. We're going to increase our computing speed. As I mentioned before, Dr. Louis Uccellini is now, and he is a big-time meteorologist. He was a winter weather expert and has written all kinds of things on winter weather, and he's now heading up the Weather Service. His goal was to not only match what the Europeans were doing in terms of their modeling capacity and speed, but to eclipse it. That money has been there, but it's almost like the old days of the CIA and the FBI, where these agencies don't trust each other. So you now have this money that's tied up and nothing has been done. So we are no better off now than we were 2 years ago with Sandy. And not only that, we pay $50,000 a month to the Europeans for that data. But we could take that money and invest it in our computing infrastructure and allow that to better serve us. But eventually it will get done. It's just going to take a while to do it because of all the gridlock that unfortunately seems to accompany a lot of things that we try to accomplish.
So it's really just a hardware issue, a software issue?
Well, there's more to it than that. But, you know, we're talking about computing speed. I mean, we can put all the variables we want into the global forecast system and get an accurate forecast, but that forecast is going to be worthless because, let's say we wanted to have a forecast for Sunday, we may not have it until next Tuesday. Well, that doesn't do you any good.
I'm amazed that the variables are so much here. And you said that in other parts of the country, not so much. By the way, the number here, 1-800-348-2551. Is the Northeast a specific challenge for a meteorologist?
Yeah, in terms of, different times of the year are more challenging than others. Certainly, especially in the wintertime, we're coming into our most challenging time of the year because of these nor'easters, and that is when these models and their modeling capabilities are so important to be able to give us the opportunity to forecast these things more than a day out. I mean, yeah. We were talking before about people being prepared, which, you know, that's on them, but it's on us to have them be in a position to be prepared. We want to give them the best forecast that we can as far out as we can.
A number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. We're joined here by meteorologist Jason Goff. I used to spend 2-3 weeks a year at different times down in Jacksonville. You could predict it every afternoon, mid to late afternoon, thunderstorm.
Yes.
Now, it's a small sample size, but I was down maybe 20 days a year for several years. Every afternoon, there was a thunderstorm. So, gets back to my earlier question, are there some areas of the country where it's just much easier to predict what's going to happen?
Oh, no doubt about it. Yeah. And, you know, what you have in Florida there is that you have like a sea breeze, thunderstorms, that's what they are. When I was in Corpus Christi, Texas, the weather was downright boring there in the summer. And I had a 2-hour morning newscast with weather hits every 10 minutes. There are only so many ways you can say hot, humid, and windy over the span of a couple of weeks' time. So, yeah, certainly. It wasn't as challenging there as it is here. Washington, D.C., the Mid-Atlantic is another place that's difficult to forecast. So it is tougher from, you know, about D.C. north. It is pretty rugged.
Number to call, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Paul in Kinderhook. Paul, you're on.
Hi there. Just wanted to ask if Jason had any opinions on technical solutions to climate change. His job is about to get really interesting in the next 30 years. And I'm wondering whether what kind of crystal ball prediction he has for how we're going to handle it.
I wish if there was a technical solution, I wish that it would come out. And Paul, I appreciate your question. We want to try to do, and I'm going to answer it, but we want to try to stick to weather as much as we can on this show, because weather and climate are two totally different things. If you guys want to have me back, I'll be glad to talk about climate change too.
Sure, and we talk about that quite a bit. So
yeah, the issue with climate change is that, you know, there can be all the technical solutions you want. The problem is that you have a lot of people out there on both sides of the argument that are getting information that is not true. And as we're talking to Ray off of Mike's before, science is not a deli. You can't pick and choose what you want. And unfortunately, it seems that both sides have kind of picked things to
cherry pick the data.
Right. And you can't do that. People have to come together and realize that this is going on and how can we curb its effects? How can we fix it? And you have people that are just so hopped up on both sides, as I said, and there are too many cookie hands in the cookie jar at the moment. Things have to settle down before we can really get to any solutions.
And Paul, thank you. And a good rule of thumb for this program, we're really talking about what your area of expertise is, and that is meteorology and the weather. So
right.
Let's go to Eric in Pittsfield. Eric. Hello. Testing 1, 2, 3.
Sometimes the Berkshires are tough with the cell phone. So, Eric, if you can get back on a line or get back into some clear things, give us a call back.
And it could be that polar vortex.
Oh, cheapers.
Might be part of the problem.
No, I've dropped some calls in the Berkshires before. I was on Roger Weiland's radio show one time and dropped off. It happens.
Oh, well. Nicholas in New Braintree, Mass. You're up. Nicholas.
Hi. I'm wondering, what is an elevated mixed layer? I gather that it's a packet of dry air. And I gather that it's above the surface. And I wonder, if it's dry and therefore heavy, why does it stay up there?
Well, you have a couple of different things at work when you're talking about different mixing layers and elevated mixed layers. It has to do with a couple of different things, Nicholas. You're talking about momentum transfer, which will happen. We will look at things like that when we're talking about downbursts. Winds coming down from a storm as a storm is dying out. But just like temperature differences, you have air density differences as well. And so just because you have more dense air aloft than you might have at the surface doesn't mean that everything is always going to layer itself out as it quote-unquote should. So in essence, what you're talking about is just having there are so many things going on in the atmosphere, especially as it starts to get churned up, as thunderstorms are getting going and tornadoes are starting to think about going. You're starting to get rotation. You're getting wind shear. So you have winds that are blowing not only, you know, horizontally like we feel here at the surface, but they're blowing in all kinds of crazy directions up aloft. And when you have these different densities in these different air masses that mix together, they are going to have some bigger impacts on the storm itself and what its capabilities will be. I don't know how much sense that makes over
makes
the radio, but it's not only temperature, but also in differences between the air masses.
What is their role in tornado formation in the Northeast?
Well, it's not only just into the Northeast, and an elevated mixing layer does not necessarily have a specific role in a tornado, because you can have elevated mixing. We've got one outside right now, I'm sure. It's just one of those things where tornadoes are going to be more, tornadoes are going to be a little bit more proficient, if you will, when you have these differences, not only in, if you have a greater difference in temperature at different layers, but also when you have greater differences in air density, but also the wind shear. So all of these things can come into factor and come into play as it relates to these storms as they get rotational and then might or might not drop a tornado.
What triggers a tornado warning? By the time a tornado warning comes, you're darn close to a tornado, right?
Well, it used to be a tornado warning wasn't issued before the days of Doppler radar. A tornado warning wasn't issued until somebody actually saw it. And that's why lead times for tornadoes back in the 70s were about 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Now they can be as much as 30. But what the Doppler radar is able to do now is you can detect winds that are coming toward the radar site and away from it. And there are parameters that are set on these radars. And if a threshold is crossed, it'll trigger a warning to be issued. And most of the time when you see tornado warnings issued by the Weather Service, it will say Doppler radar has indicated a possible tornado. And then if somebody makes confirmation, a sheriff's deputy or a weather spotter, somebody like that, then they'll put out an additional statement. But we can issue now warnings just based on what the Doppler radar is seeing.
1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. Before we get to Ann in Clifton Park, you know, you talk about Doppler radar, and there are certain terms we hear from meteorologists every day on every weather forecast. Explain what the Doppler radar really does. I've heard of the Doppler effect, where if there's a horn on a car and he goes far away from you, the pitch goes down. How does that translate?
Well, basically the way that a Doppler works is it spends most of its time listening. It sends out these little pulses of energy. It's not like a beam, like a laser beam. It sends out these pulses of energy, and then it listens, in essence, to hear what comes back.
Okay.
So on a day like this, a Doppler radar is going to be in what they call clear air mode,
And nothing's coming back?
Nothing's coming back. Or actually, things could come back, especially now with the new dual polarization radars. You can pick up flocks of birds. You can pick up insects. You can pick up all kinds of stuff. That's how good these things are. So, in essence, what the Doppler radar is like a big listening device, but it's sort of an agitator. It'll send out a pulse. Then it will listen for this thing to come back, and then it can determine the strength of the schedule, or the schedule, the strength of the signal
right.
as it comes back will then determine how strong a storm may be, for example. And those obviously correlate to the colors that you see on the screen.
And you need more than one? In other words, do you need more than one transmitter to make this data more three-dimensional?
No, because what these things do is that they scan the atmosphere up in increments. So the farther out you go away from a radar, the less reliable it is, because especially in the wintertime, you might have a radar pulses that'll go over the top of some snow if it's real low, or you know, if it's lower into the atmosphere. So that's basically what these things do, is they just listen, and then depending on where the sound is coming from, it'll determine whether it's coming toward or away from the radar site.
Jason Goff is our guest. Plenty of calls, and Ann's got another question about a term that we hear all the time, and we'll get to that one next. It's Vox Pop on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, presenting the Round the Lake Challenge, providing 30 missions to explore Lake George, lglc.org. The Honest Weight Food Co-op, located at 100 Waterville Ave in Albany, offering local and organic produce, groceries, specialty foods, and more, honestweight.coop. Ashokan Center, Olive Bridge, New York, a classroom in the wild helping schools, organizations, and individuals reconnect with nature, history, and the arts, ashokancenter.org. Sweater Venture, East Greenbush, New York, 35 years of hand-knitting fair trade sweaters and accessories in support of indigenous communities around the world, sweaterventure.com. And the City of Kingston, home to the annual O Positive Festival, bartering the art of medicine for the medicine of art. 3 days of public art, music performances, and a health expo and clinic for participants, October 10th through 12th, kingston.opositivefestival.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. We talk weather, and oh, the winter is coming, and oh, I don't look forward to it. I got to buy a snowblower.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, mine finally died after 12 years.
Hey,
seized up.
You got your money's worth out of it.
Yeah, and I think I'm going to need it. I got a feeling.
All right, well, we'll touch base in February and see how you're feeling.
And I'm blaming you, man. All right, let's go to Ann in Clifton Park. Ann.
Hi.
Hi.
I do have a terminology question. Ray, you segued so well into that with
that's
your whole
stop
bar
yes.
thing. Yes. Okay, so every day on WAMC, I hear talk of heating degree days. What are heating degree days, and why do we care?
Well, I will answer both of those questions, and hopefully you will have a better understanding. Heating degree days simply are, they're a number. They're on a basis of 65 degrees. So what you do is you determine for heating degree days, let's say we had on a day like yesterday, for example, 40 degree low, 70 degree high, okay? Mm. Add those two numbers together, you get 110. Divided by 2 is 55. So yesterday we had 10 heating degree days. It all has to do with energy consumption. Heating degree day, and so this is why we care, Ann, and this is a much more important point. We care because we want to spend as little money as we can on energy and what the energy companies will do, natural gas, coal, heating oil, they will use heating degree days and try to forecast what the heating degree days will be in the upcoming cold seasons or in the warming seasons too.
To what degree of accuracy, though?
Well, that's a good question. I don't follow the trades that closely as it relates to energy consumption and all of that. I follow my own. I know how much natural gas I use every month and stuff. But what they do is they will set prices based on heating degree forecast or futures, as they're called. Mm. And it you know, energy is a commodity. You know, that was the case after the late 70s when it was put on the market. So cooling degree days are the same way down in places like Florida and Texas. They want to know how much energy is going to be used, and this is a sort of a good numerical way to quantify it.
All right, so if you don't own a natural – assuming Ann doesn't own a natural gas company, Why should she be that concerned about heating degree days?
Well, it's basically because you will know, I suppose at the end of the season, you'll have an idea of how much more energy you use than maybe you had budgeted for. It's just a good measure of energy consumption. Hmm. Energy companies use it for future predictions as far as how much energy they're going to use, which ultimately determines prices of, you know, heating oil, natural gas, and coal and all of those things, so that, you know, we want to obviously spend as little as possible, and they want to charge as much as possible, so we've got to have something in the middle.
What do you think,
Ann? Is the idea that if the heating degree number is higher, then we're using more energy?
No, well, a heating degree day, yes, the
in other words, if we have 20 heating degree days instead of 10, we've used more
then you've
energy.
Used right. Then you will have used twice. You know, you will
Got
have
it.
Used.
Okay.
It's not a linear thing, but you will. You would not have used. You would have used more energy to heat your house with 20 heating degree days than with 10.
Okay, thank you.
And
you're
thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551. Peter in Warwick. Peter.
Hey, Jason, I have a question for you. I grew up along the beach on the Jersey Shore, and nobody that I've ever met or have lived with throughout the Northeast ever refers to the storm that comes from the Northeast as a nor'easter. The only place we've ever heard that has been on the media. So why is that?
Really?
Oh, I've heard of it.
I've heard this way. I've studied weather since I was a little kid, and I've always heard nor'easters in textbooks and things. What were they called when you were down in New Jersey, Peter?
Well, nor'easter. Nobody refers to it as a nor'easter. You know, if they do, you get weird looks and people start laughing.
I see what you're saying. So, I don't know. It's sort of like, you know,
the main thing,
forecastle or forecastle. You know what I mean? It's just part of the vernacular. Ultimately, they're called that a nor'easter because of the wind direction as the storm goes by. And
I understand where the term comes from. It's just a pronunciation.
That's a great question.
Okay, yeah.
You say tomato and I say tomato.
Right.
But down in Jersey, they say, "Hey, here comes a big storm." Hey,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Right. that's a good question. I don't have an answer for you other than I'm just speculating that it's just something that when you hear a lot of the old vernacular, especially from Mariners, you see a lot of those types of terms that just sort of showed up.
Yeah. Great question.
Even as a Mariner, I've done sailing all my life. We never refer to it as a nor'easter. It was always a pretty big friggin' storm, a nor'easter.
Thank you for saying it that way, Peter. We appreciate it. Let's go to Jack in Rosendale. Jack, you're on.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
All right.
All right. I have a couple questions for you, but let's start with, I just heard you say that you spent pretty much most of your life going ahead and studying the skies and the atmosphere and studying the weather. How much time do you physically spend outside studying the weather or the atmosphere to determine what you think the weather is going to be?
Well, in short term, I'll do it all the time, man, especially in the summertime. I'm going to want to see what the winds are doing. You know, when you see clouds that are zipping by over your head, how high up are they?
Does it help with all the technology you have at your fingertips?
It helps. I mean, nothing, you know, the technology that we have is fantastic. But, you know, I'm in a sense kind of old school as well, and nothing beats looking at the sky, looking through your own eyes to kind of observe things on your own. You wouldn't want to do that solely as a forecasting tool now.
Yeah.
We don't want to dismiss all of this, you know, great technology.
Expensive technology.
But I want to be able to also to just to kind of go and see, especially, you know, how much lightning is a storm throwing? I want to see that. I want to see what the winds are doing. I want to see if the storm is rotating. I want to see if the sky has that sort of greenish appearance to it, which is hail.
Yes.
You've
just answered a question I've had for my entire lifetime.
Yep. So, yeah, I like to go out and check it out for sure, you know, and just to see as things are coming in. And, you know, and it's a good thing to do. I mean, obviously, American Indians and farmers and people that have spent a lot of time outdoors, they're experts at it. They're able to do this, and people that spend time out on the water. But anybody out on any lakes or whatever in the summertime hiking, camping, you should always keep your eyes to the sky and know what it is that you're looking at to try to get a real short-term forecast.
Awesome. Next question would be, do you think that I've noticed, like, over the course of my life, I'm 43, it seems to me that the jets travel overhead, the stream they leave behind them is an awful lot longer than it was when I was a kid. And I have an excellent memory. Yes, and I was wondering, do you think that our government or possibly corporations are using these trails to stimulate weather patterns?
No, I do not. No, I don't.
Okay.
I do not. And,
okay, well, I'll take my tinfoil hat off after that. Okay.
Thank you,
Jack,
very much.
Thanks a lot for the call. All right. Yeah, let's go to John in Utica. John, you're on.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. I live down in the Melbourne area of Florida, listening to the radio one time. And the weather forecast, the guy used the term low-level moisture. Was he using a fancy term for fog, or is low-level moisture something totally different?
No, low-level moisture is what we deal with here on the, at the surface. You know, when you hear about relative humidity and dew points, that's essentially what low-level moisture is. You know, when we look at the atmosphere in slices, we try to figure out what the weather is going to be, not only on the ground, but also up into the mid and upper levels of the atmosphere. And different, we were talking before about elevated mixing levels. You have different sort of layers, if you will, of higher moisture content, lower moisture content. All of that plays into, especially down in Florida, you know, what you're talking about in terms of thunderstorms, torrential rains, and things like that. So if you have low-level moisture but dry air in the mid-levels of the atmosphere, that's going to inhibit any kind of real big storm growth unless you've got something coming through to stir things up a bit. So that's basically all it is.
So it's a level of humidity, is that what you're saying?
Low-level moisture. I don't know what in what capacity somebody would use that in a forecast, especially if you're, you know, on the radio or on television
good.
To do it. Yeah, it sounds good, but, you know, you just say, hey, the dew point is this, and it's muggy out, or it's not. That's basically it.
Okay.
John, thanks
very
a lot
fine.
For the call.
Thanks.
Thanks.
I appreciate you listening all the way out there in Utica. Nice to hear from you, where we have a transmitter, of course. Here's one hot off the presses. This is a handed to me by Jessica Blaustein Marshall email from Brian in Duanesburg. As I follow weather forecasts and conditions closely, I was wondering how one could become a weather spotter. I would assume it requires regular reporting or maintaining telemetry equipment. Is calibrated equipment supplied? Could I still go on vacation? Brian in Duanesburg.
Yes, Brian. We're not going to strap you to a tree and make you give us a
lifetime weather spotter.
Yeah. Once you're in, you're in for life.
That's right.
No, that's not the case. There are a couple of different ways to do that. One is actually a really good program that the National Weather Service has had for years. The folks over at the Weather Service office here are great. Ray O'Keefe and Steve DiRienzo and the whole staff over there, John, they're all great. And they, like all Weather Service offices around the country, they have a program that's called Skywarn.
Yeah, and ham radio operators do this
as
well.
Yeah, and ham radio operators are invaluable when it comes to stuff like that in terms of being, you know, certified spotters. As far as a little bit more informal spotters that we have, News Channel 13, especially in the mornings, but I like to have them at any time. You don't need any special equipment. We like observations, you know, hail size, snowfall amounts, wind damage, anything like that. If you have a thermometer that'll give a temperature, that's great as well. And it's completely, you know, voluntary. But if you want to be a weather spotter out in Duanesburg or anywhere else, shoot us an email, weather@WNYT.com, and we'll get you started.
Assuming that somebody supplies his own equipment, how do you know that that equipment is any good? Just looking at the data day after day and saying, oh, this guy's way off.
Yeah, you know, we can get an idea if somebody emails in and says, well, it's, you know, 60 out here in Chatham and it's 40 everywhere else, you know. But generally speaking, all of our weather spotters are very competent and they're loyal and they gave us some good information and we really appreciate it. They're most important, by the way, in the wintertime. Weather spotters are so important in the wintertime because we can get an idea of what the precipitation type is. That helps us out immensely. Speaking of a place like Chatham, say, you know, we're getting sleet or freezing rain here and it's pounding snow in Albany. And, you know, having extra sets of eyes, boots on the ground is invaluable.
Is that something Doppler radar will not give you, the specific cutoff line between sleet and snow?
No, we can get that. There are algorithms that are built into it. But, you know, it still is always good to have eyeballs and somebody verbally saying it's sleeting here than rather to have to solely rely on the radar. The radar that we have and use in the wintertime is fantastic with precipitation type, and it's always very close. But it's always good to have people on the ground to let us know, too.
All right, let's go to Mike in Wilbraham. Mike, you're on.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
I have a plausible answer to why cows lay down when it's going to rain.
All right.
Okay.
Well, my great aunt Flossie up in Vermont, when I was a kid going up to visit there, she said that even though they're getting rained on, that they have a dry spot to lay in.
Makes sense.
Make sense.
Yeah, sense. I think I would lay down too.
So yeah. That's why they lay down, so they'll have a dry spot even though they're getting rained on.
Brilliant.
They don't mind. I like it. Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
Let's go to Richard in Queensbury. Richard.
Hi. I had a question about your Weather Channel. How come all that data you presented up until a few months ago has disappeared?
That's out of my hands, brother. I don't know what to tell you. Yeah,
is
we
a sore subject.
No, it's not a sore subject.
I'm dependent on that stuff for weather prediction, and now I got to go to Channel 10. You know.
All right now. All
yeah,
right,
no.
You don't have to slap Jason around here.
No, it's we have tweaked some things around the station, but a lot of that that stuff, all I can tell you, and I'm not trying to throw anybody at the station under the bus,
no, please
but
don't.
It's sort of out of our hands. So
okay.
We do the best we can. We have the radar that's on there, and at the moment, that's what we've got.
Fair enough. Well said. Frederick in Beacon. Frederick, you're on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Just a quick question. How is it possible that you can have two totally different types of clouds forming in the same sky at the same exact time? I always wonder how that can happen, if you can, if the weather conditions are one thing, shouldn't form pretty much one cloud over your head.
Well, you know, that's a good question, and we were talking before about variables and modeling. There's a lot of stuff going on in the skies, man. You know, and you have, so you can have cumulus, and you can have stratus, and you can have cirrus as well.
All at different heights?
All at different heights. And it just depends on what's going on in the atmosphere. It depends on your wind velocity, that is speed and direction. It depends on how much moisture is available in the atmosphere. It depends on how much cold air is in the atmosphere. And so you can have, and all at different layers and different levels. It just depends on sort of the atmosphere du jour, I guess you could say. But certainly you can get all kinds of different clouds. You might have cumulus that might look different, but they're actually called stratocumulus because they're getting the tops of those are getting kind of sheared off on the in the wake of a cold front, for example.
I gotcha. And you actually sparked a really, really quick question. I don't know if you can answer this. There's a certain term that I always wanted to know. What's the term called, if there is one, for the when you look up in the distance, maybe over a mountain, you'll see some rain falling and it evaporates before it hits the ground, and you just see the dusting of the rain falling.
Yes.
I'm not sure if there's a term for that.
It's called virga, V-I-R-G-A. Huh. And
that's it.
Yeah, you see that a lot. I mean, you could see that really anywhere, but you see that especially in the deserts,
right,
and stuff like that, where the air is so dry that the rain will actually evaporate before it hits the ground. That's a big deal for us around here. I mean, it's a big deal for anywhere, too, but we use that a lot in the wintertime when we're trying to forecast precipitation type, because as the snowfall or rain evaporates before it hits the ground, it actually cools the air around it. So that has implications on the short-term forecast as well. So we're always interested in the not in the virga itself, but the atmosphere around those clouds that produce that.
Thank you, Frederick.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Appreciate it. And you bring up a great point. This must be why it's so maddening to try to figure out a modeling software setup, because the smallest thing will change it all. How do you not go mad?
I almost did last night. We were forecasting because we're the storm that's coming up tomorrow. How far north is it going to go? In the 10 o'clock newscast, it was all the way up to Saratoga. And in our 11 o'clock newscast, it was as far north as Kingston.
Oh, boy.
That's quite a difference.
Yeah,
but
it is.
And that's a model. That's one model run from the next. So that's what we call a low confidence forecast.
Well, Jason Goff, always great to have you here. When's your next broadcast?
I will be on tonight at 10 o'clock over on My4 and then at News Channel 13 live at 11.
So how long does it take to get that ready, get your weathercast ready?
You know, on a day like this, it'll take me a little longer just because I want to see what's going on with the storm down to our south and all of that. But it'll take me a few hours, get some graphics built. We've got a lot of stuff going on this weekend, so I always like to give those events some plugs and some forecasts. Friday night football, so lots going on tonight in the world of weather.
Well, man, thanks for being here. We'll have you on again soon. Thanks to everybody who called in. Support comes from the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, protecting New York's historic buildings, district, and landscape since 1970. 1974, preservenys.org. The Cheese Traveler, Albany, New York, featuring over 100 cheeses, cured meats, grilled cheese sandwiches, Tillsdale Farm organic beef and pork, artisan pantry items, and cheese classes, thecheesetraveler.com. And Barry Price Architecture, since 1996, specializing in buildings that integrate modernism and sustainability with regional materials and aesthetics, barrypricearchitecture.com. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who handled the controls. Colleen O'Connell answered your calls. Jessica Blaustein Marshall is our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the program, even though the winter is fast approaching, the gardening show tomorrow. Stay tuned now for a news update.